everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's April 2025, and you're listening to episode 439, which is a spoiler-filled conversation about the film Juror Number 2, directed by Clint Eastwood. On this episode, I'm joined by David Hagopian, who is partner and general counselor at CDF Labor Law in Irvine, California, where he is an employment defense and business trial attorney. David has written an online film review article for the Christian Research Journal, and his review is called "The Juror Number 2 in Everyone." And you can read his review for free at equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. David, it's great to have you back on the podcast.
Melanie, it's great to be back with you again. Thanks for having me today.
Well, some of our listeners, maybe even longtime listeners, may not remember that David was one of our first and early guests. So the last time he was on this podcast was way back in episode 48. So we have had almost 400 episodes since then. We're going towards 450, which we'll hit in June. So I am so excited to have him back on the podcast because so many people nowadays have a great interest in legal issues. And so when a film comes along, like the one we're going to discuss, as I mentioned, is spoiler heavy on this podcast, it is of interest for people because it seems to mirror some cases in real life. Now, of course, I want to preface this because, as I noted in the intro, that David is an attorney. None of our conversation, please don't construe it as legal advice or anything like that. We're just kind of talking about some of the issues because he has an expertise, of course, as an attorney. And so I would like to ask David a little bit about this film because some people might not realize that this film came out. It wasn't in the theaters for very long, and I think it's probably one of the last films that Clint Eastwood will ever direct since he's in his 90s. So tell us a little bit about Juror Number 2. Now, before we get to the plot, what did you really like about this film?
Well, I really liked how well written it was by Jonathan Abrams, and it was also, Melanie, particularly well acted. I can't think, having seen the film a couple of times now, that there was not a weak link in the film at all in terms of acting. It's a very compelling and gripping legal thriller. As you mentioned, it was co-produced and directed by Clint Eastwood, so it may very well be one of the last films that we'll all ever have an opportunity to see that was directed by him. The film stars Nicholas Holt, who plays the role of a character named Justin Kemp, who is a journalist and called to serve on a jury trial for a murder trial. And as he begins his jury service tenure, he comes to realize that he's responsible for the victim's death. And I assume that we're on a spoiler alert here for all of your listeners today.
Oh, yes. Like I mentioned, it is going to be spoiler heavy. So, you know, I will definitely say if you want to really not know anything about our analysis, turn it off, go see the movie, and then come back to this episode. So is there anything else that you liked about the film as an attorney watching the film?
I thought many of the legal scenes were compellingly delivered. There is one little pet peeve I have as a lawyer that many non-lawyers may be unaware of, Melanie, and that is oftentimes in TV and the movies, for the sake of dramatic effect, they show lawyers walking in the space between counsel's table and the bench where the judge sits. That area is called the well, and first-year lawyers know very well. In fact, first-year law students know very well that no lawyer is ever allowed to walk in that space. The judge will harshly criticize you, even in front of the jury, if you try to do that. And the only time you can approach is with permission by the judge. Even approaching the witness is generally speaking a no-no unless you've asked for the permission that's been granted to you by the court.
So besides that, you know, typical, maybe erroneous way that lawyers are portrayed in this film, is there something else that you didn't like about the film as an attorney?
Well, not necessarily, Melanie, as an attorney. It's always hard to watch even legal thrillers where You watch innocent people go down. We don't want to ever see that in real life, day to day. And it's certainly challenging to watch, you know, as an attorney even. But it was portrayed very, very well in the film. And unfortunately, you know, our legal system doesn't always get things right. And I'm sure we're going to get to that topic as we continue today.
So as you saw the film and you mentioned that you've watched it a couple of times, I did see it once and I did agree with you that it is very compelling. And you, there's so many questions that I have. So I'm so glad that you're on this podcast. We're going to get to some of them later. Just questions too, because I've served on a jury before and I think it's a little bit different than what they portrayed. Not to say that, well, I'll ask you a little bit more about jury service later, but like that there's not field trips or things like that, that perhaps that does also happen rarely in real life, but just how they do the jury selection, they just try to make it very short and things like that. But what are some of the takeaways that you came away with this film? Because I had some, and that's why I want to ask you about it later, one of those being jury service, but are there other primary takeaways that you had?
Yeah, there was one particular theme that, you know, ran through the film in the middle of jury deliberations where one of the characters conducted an independent investigation outside of the presence of the court. And though this may be difficult for many, many non-lawyers to grasp, the legal system takes a very, very harsh view of conducting independent investigations, you know, outside of court. Jurors are not allowed to do that at all. And that's to protect the veracity and accuracy of the trial outcome. I don't know if you remember, but, you know, one of the particular jurors was a former detective. His name was Harold Chakowsky in the film, played by J.K. Simmons, played it very well. The role was compellingly delivered. But, you know, one of the things that he did in the midst of jury deliberations was to gather a list of local body shops of cars that were delivered in and around at the time of the victim's death. The victim is Kendall Carter, by the way, played by Francesca Eastwood. And that kind of thing is strictly forbidden. In fact, the film does accurately portray even that, Melanie, at the beginning of the trial, that every judge will issue with a pre-instruction to the jury that the jurors are not allowed to conduct any independent research, analysis, or any kind of independent investigation like the one that Harold conducted in the midst of the deliberations.
So now I want to ask you a little bit more about the plot of the film so that people can get an idea, because you just touched on it a few moments ago. But what's the overall plot? Because you just mentioned this independent investigation of this film. And why is it called Juror Number Two? Because that has to do with the main character. And so kind of just give us the plot. And then I would like to know, basically, the main character, Justin Kemp, how could he have avoided what happened in the film?
Right. Well, if it's okay with you, Melanie, I'll just back up and explain why he's called Juror Number Two. I mean, the number obviously is somewhat random, but it was the number he was given when he was called and interviewed. We call that process voir dire, or jury selection, as it's more commonly known. Some of them are conducted by judges. Oftentimes, the lawyers get to ask questions of potential jurors themselves. Jurors are assigned a number, and then they're called and asked various questions. And then the lawyers get an opportunity to challenge jurors for cause or without cause. You're given a limited number of without cause strikes or challenges. And the court often can exercise its own discretion too, Melanie, in terms of excusing jurors. So the fact that he was given, you know, number two is just the number that he was assigned as a potential juror when he sat on the box facing jury selection questions from counsel. In terms of the overall theme of the film or the overall plot of the film, the victim, as I mentioned, is named Kendall Carter, played by Francesca Eastwood. The accused is her boyfriend. His name is James Michael Scythe, played by Gabriel Basso. And they pretty much got into a loud verbal altercation at a local watering hole. He became unruly. After the argument, she tears off and walks out, of course, into pouring rain, which is a major theme in the film from that point forward. She walks down what we later learn to be a two-lane road or highway. Scythe appears to pursue her. Then she ultimately turns up dead under a bridge. What we later come to learn, again, another spoiler alert for your listeners today, is that James Michael Scythe actually turned away from where the victim was walking, made a U-turn, actually. But juror number two, Justin Kemp, actually continued on down the road. And then ultimately, hears a loud thud against his car. It's pouring rain. Visibility is very, very bad. He looks up and sees a deer crossing sign. Gets out of his car for a little while to look around, doesn't really see much because it's also a dark evening, and then gets back in his car and continues on his way home. So that's kind of the setup for everything that follows.
So basically what happens is in the film, Justin Kemp, that character that David just mentioned, hit something that he thought was a deer. And he was driving and the visibility was poor. And then also, just as a backstory element, you know, this character in the past had a drinking problem and he was at this bar, but he didn't actually drink. And he was in some distress because there were some personal issues he had at home, but he didn't drink. And then he went through this pouring rain and down that road that you mentioned. So now he finds himself and he doesn't know. He's got a call, a summons to jury duty, like most all of us, if we're adults, even if we're students in college and we're over 18, we've received that jury summons. And so he's actually gone in for jury duties in a small Georgia town. And he realizes as the case unfolds that he's involved in it. How could he have maybe avoided some of this moral dilemma that starts to unfold kind of to the horror of the viewer as well?
Right. Well, that's a great question, Melanie. As you know, my view is that he made several bad decisions, and we can get to some of them later. But I think his first bad decision was on the night I was just describing that you were just alluding to, when he obviously hit something with his vehicle on his way home from the local bar. True, he did not have anything to consume that night, but he did, you know, relapse of sorts, obviously, by showing up at the bar and ordering a drink. He just never ended up consuming it, at least so he told his wife. But I think his first bad decision was not calling the police at the scene of the incident. I believe if he had done that, the rest of what we would have had a much shorter movie, of course, and it would not have been very engaging. But the rest of what happens never happens because the police, obviously, in the course of conducting their investigation that night and perhaps the next day in broad daylight, would have seen exactly what happened. And it would have been an unfortunate and sad accident that would have resulted in Kendall Carter's passing. But that's probably where the story would have started and stopped. Unfortunately, by not getting out, he set kind of the rest of the events in motion. And I think, you know, a second bad decision that we haven't yet discussed was lying to his wife when he got home that evening by saying that he took another path home because he wanted to hide the fact that he had been at the bar and that he had ordered a drink. That decision later made her somewhat complicit in a concerted decision that they both made. Their family should remain safe at all costs because she was expecting a child. But his third bad decision, and this is the one I think you were just alluding to, Melanie, is that, you know, he obviously is facing a conflict of interest. That's the major plot line in the film. And as soon as he realized that he was responsible for the victim's death, he should have come forward. But I think he could have potentially come forward much earlier as well, because very early as the trial is just getting underway, at least as portrayed in the film. So it's very, very early on in the film and very early on in the trial. He does recall being at that bar the night that Carter and Scythe got into their verbal altercation. And if he had remembered that fact, Melanie, and relayed that to the judge, he probably would have been excused from further service on the jury. I can't imagine any judge retaining a juror who had some personal knowledge about the events in question, because jurors are not supposed to have personal knowledge about the events in question.
Even though the Christian Research Journal now is completely online, we want to hear from you. We would like to engage with your thoughts about our articles and also welcome any suggestions you may have for things that you think we should cover on this podcast and you would like to see articles written about in the Christian Research Journal, whether it's on cults, apologetics, cultural apologetics, ethics, or Christian theology. So we welcome you to contact us, and how you do that is through our email address, which is response@equip.org. That's response@equip.org. And we welcome letters to the editor. It's just that they're all online now. And again, your suggestions and your thoughts and comments about our content. Of course, every week I would like to invite you to partner with us by giving us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, which is pretty much one of the sites where the majority of the people subscribe to podcasts worldwide. And so when you put your even quickly starred review, or even if you could spare a moment and give us a sentence or two of why you'd like to listen to this podcast, it really helps us out, because then our podcast is suggested to other people who might be interested in Christian apologetics. So it's been a while since we had an actual sentence review about our podcast. And so would you take a moment to please do that and all the other things? Let people know about us and push out any of the episodes on your socials if you enjoy this content. So thank you for listening to this podcast regularly. And now back to my conversation with David Hagopian about the film Juror Number Two. We were just kind of talking about some flaws that the character made and, you know, what should he have done to make it a shorter film. But speak to our listeners, because when you're in the moment, it is very hard to know what decisions to make. And I say this on a very small level. Last Christmas, I got into a hit and run. In other words, I was in my car and someone hit my car and I couldn't believe it. I thought I didn't, you know, turn on the parking brake or something, because my car lurched forward. And then I got out and I realized somebody had hit my car because I was in a parking lot and they were backing up. Thankfully, someone took a photo of it, but it was a very long, torturous situation. I mean, finally my car got fixed. But here's what I want to say about that is, so, you know, I was in a Trader Joe's parking lot. The employee came out, was also seeing it. There were some people that were noticing it, and she ran through as this person just hightailed it and left. And so then we called the police because they hit my car and left. And then someone gave me a photo of blurry photo of this car like leaving. And so the police came, and at the time the police said to me, we finally figured out what the license plate is. And he said, do you want to press charges? So I didn't know what that meant. Now in my state, a hit and run, even if no one is injured, is a misdemeanor. And I think it's kind of a high class misdemeanor actually. And so it's Christmas. I'm like, oh, I don't want to do that to someone. I'm like, no, because he said, here's the thing, you know, if you want to press charges, then we'll pull all the video cam and all this stuff. And I'm thinking, that's not going to be a big deal. This person ran off. He said, I figured out where they lived. I'm going to go to their house, but they could lie to me. So if you want to press charges, you know, you should do that. But I don't know what that meant for me. So anyway, I made the fatal flaw not to press charges, and I won't get into the drama, but a whole bunch of other stuff happened and it's taken a while to resolve. Thankfully, well, but it was kind of interesting because they were lying about the fact that they were there. And what do we do? You know, so you don't know as a person. So I can imagine he hit something. He's like feeling drama from his, you know, oh no, I have to go home and tell my wife. Do I want to tell her where I was? So how do we make those clear-headed decisions when we're in that? And by the way, I was on my way to a Messiah performance at my church, and I'm just like wanting to, and I'm like, no, I don't want to press charges. I just got to leave and do this, but I should have pressed charges. So how do we make those decisions? Because they're very emotional things. Someone just hit my car. I'm trying to get to church. I'm trying to be nice and not, you know, press charges against someone, and not realizing later they're going to deny that this happened, even though we have a photo of their car there, etc.
Yeah, I hear where you're coming from, Melanie. And sometimes kind of in the heat of the moment, or, you know, in the middle of a crisis, it's harder to make you know, completely rational decisions. And I certainly understand the decision you made in your circumstance. The conflict of interest portrayed in the film, though, kind of went well beyond that, because long after the night at issue, you know, the fateful night at issue, I guess we could call it, he clearly realized in the middle of the trial that he was responsible for Kendall Carter's death. And then the rest, as the rest of the film unfolds, he goes about the task of pretty much trying to conceal that fact from counsel and the court and the accused. His first initial plan is to try to convince the jury that Scythe was innocent, figuring that his own legal predicament would go away with a not guilty verdict. But he faces an immediate uphill battle because most of the rest, if not all of the rest of the jurors at that time during deliberations, believed that Scythe was guilty. But, you know, then when the heat got turned up on him, especially as Harold Schakowsky conducted his independent body shop investigation, it was obvious that the guns, as it were, metaphorically speaking, were going to turn on him. It's then obvious that he did vote for Scythe to be guilty in the end, though he's not there when the verdict is delivered because he's in the hospital with his wife as his daughter's been born. But there needed to be a unanimous jury, obviously, and he obviously pinned his own guilt on Scythe, which is you know, the ultimate conflict of interest, basically blaming somebody else for your own wrongdoing. So there are various stages in the film where he clearly could have come forward soberly and rationally thinking, but failed to do so. And that's kind of the conflict that the film is all about.
Now, just for our listeners, I'm going to ask you a little bit later about jury duty, but if they haven't served on a jury, you said they came into the jury room thinking that Scythe was guilty. What normally happens in just, you know, not in depth, but in the process? You've heard a whole case and now you go to deliberation. So as the juror, you go into the jury room. What is the process of being on a juror? Like, what happens when you get into that jury room?
Sure. Do you want me to start at the very beginning with the jury selection? Just kind of give your listeners an
idea. That would be great, because the whole point of this thing is he's been selected to be on a jury. And you did talk about, I've heard other people say it, voir dire, whatever it's called, you know, when the people, and I actually, and we're going to talk about it a little bit later, was selected to be on a jury and did serve. But there were people who objected to be the people selected in the group, saying, I cannot be on this jury because of the nature of the case, which was criminal child abuse. So how, and that can go in the process. So why don't you walk us through the process? Because one thing I was surprised to learn when I was a juror, that I cannot sit there and take notes. I can only just listen to what's presented and try to recall everything from both sides before I enter into that jury room.
Sure. Yeah. Let's take it from the beginning, just because many listeners may have never had the privilege of serving to date, and they may even have, you know, slightly different experiences than you and I have had. I'll get to it in a minute, but I was only impaneled on a jury once because most lawyers don't want to select lawyers to be members of their juries. But so the process starts with what's called a jury summons that you get in the mail. I should add that there's a state court system in every state, and then there are federal courts that sit in every jurisdiction as well. And so I'm going to be talking mostly about the state court process, but in any event, you get a summons to serve. That summons is literally a legal mandate coming from the court system for you to show up on a specific date and time to serve. Those jury summons are issued based on what the courts, you know, expect to be their need for juries. Not every trial is a jury trial, I should also add, Melanie. Some trials are what we call bench trials. Those are trials presided over by the judge, where the judge acts as the legal fact finder as well. But criminal trials are required to be jury unless jury is waived by the accused. Sometimes juries are required for trials, and sometimes they're allowed if a party or parties choose to have a jury hear their case. And so you get this jury summons, and it summons you to appear. Usually there are directions on the back. In the old days, you used to have to call in, but now you can log in, obviously. If you have a scheduling conflict of some kind, or you're unable to serve for legally permissible reasons, you're allowed to postpone or opt out of jury service. And we'll get to why, you know, I believe Christians should embrace their civic duty to serve in a little bit here. But when you do show up, in some court systems, you can call in and fulfill your jury service obligation just by calling in every day. The last several times that I've received a jury summons, that's been the deal, where by day three or four, you know if you're going to get called in or not. But if you get, you know, called in, then you sit in a jury room waiting to be assigned to a specific court. That can be a somewhat random process that depends on whatever the court system uses to kind of take the jury pools up to the courtroom. So you go up with a jury pool that's reasonably sized for the trial. If it's a particularly long trial, they pre-qualify jurors, Melanie. Only jurors that can serve on an extended basis will be part of that jury pool. You then get up and you sit in the courtroom, and they'll call at least, you know, 12 people into the jury box, and then they'll start interviewing those people in the box. And as they get excused, other people in the jury pool will fill their places. And eventually the goal is to impanel a jury. Here in California, it's a 12 juror jury panel. In the federal court here in the Central District of California, many listeners might not realize it's only 6 jurors. But each trial also has to have an alternative juror or alternative jurors who serve in case something happens to a jury member and the jury member can't fulfill their duty to stay kind of in the jury for the duration of the trial. In fact, that even happens in the film. If you recall, there's an alternative juror who replaces one of the jurors, Harold Chakowsky, when he gets excused by the judge for conducting his independent investigation. An alternate kind of takes his place. It's very, very important for the alternates. They basically sit there and are engaged in the entire trial, are listening in court every single day, because they have to be able to fulfill the role of a juror. If a juror gets sick or can't basically see the trial through to conclusion, then the trial starts here. You know, prosecution obviously carries the burden of proof. We'll get to that in a minute. So the prosecution presents its case in chief, as we call it. The defense then presents its case in chief, and then prosecution will get an opportunity to present a rebuttal case. And then when both sides rest, i.e. they're done presenting their evidence to the jury, then the jury is instructed by the judge on the law that the jury is to follow. And then the jury is then excused to the jury room to deliberate. In this instance, a guilty or not guilty verdict, because this is a criminal proceeding. And this jury was required to reach a unanimous verdict, which is kind of one of the tension points in the film, because Justin Kemp appears to be the only character, at least early on through the first vote, who was willing to cast a vote of not guilty, mostly because he thought that, as I mentioned earlier, that he thought his own legal predicament would go away if Scythe were a not guilty. And if the jury cannot ultimately reach a verdict, it's what we call a deadlock jury. They're deadlocked. And that could result in the proceedings ending. And then it would be up to the prosecution in this instance to choose whether to try to prosecute him again.
Well, that was really helpful to help us understand the process, even between state and federal jurors. And I have to ask you, though, as we've been talking about this film, as a lawyer, is it hard to watch a legal movie? Because you did mention some things that they got wrong about, you know, walking in the well or whatever. Is it hard for you to watch that sometimes? I know sometimes when I'm reading a book, I was recently reading a book by someone called Yuval Noah Harari. It's about AI, but it's a very anti-Christian book. And he just starts making he's a historian, but he starts making all these like statements of fact about Christianity that were just so wrong. I was just almost like exclaiming out loud, are you kidding me? Because the average Christian apologist could probably answer some of the things he was saying. So when you see that legal movie, is it hard to watch? And do you wince sometimes? So you're like, oh, this is not how it works.
I think sometimes, you know, this one was very well done, you know, with just some minor tweaks here and there. And most directors, you know, have legal consultants kind of, you know, at the ready or whatever to make sure it's as accurate as possible. You know, I think it might be harder for doctors to watch medical shows, I would imagine, than it is for most lawyers to watch legal thrillers of one type or another, because most of them are actually pretty well done these days. Not all of them, and not all the time, of course.
Well, I want to wrap up our jury, you know, discussion, go back to that. Is like you mentioned jury service and Christians. I would have to say probably most universally, as I, you know, if I get a jury summons, whether someone's a Christian or a non-Christian, I pretty much hear that people are trying to figure out how they can get out of jury service. I get jury service can be very inconvenient. It was inconvenient for me when I did serve. But why do you think it's important for Christians to serve on a jury?
Yeah, I don't know if you could hear me giggling. It's probably not funny, but I think it's pretty commonplace at dinner parties or, you know, when you're grabbing a cup of coffee at the office or what have you, to have people trade stories about how they successfully evaded jury service. I guess maybe we start, Melanie, with the observation that it's never going to be completely convenient, that there's going to be some inconvenience involved. I think we could all readily acknowledge that fact. But I think that for Christians, the response would be twofold. First of all, you know, in Romans chapter 13, verses 1 through 3, we're called to obey lawful authorities and their lawful or just mandates. And as I mentioned before, jury service starts with a jury summons, which is a legal mandate to serve. And so I think if we as believers keep in mind the fact that it's a mandate to serve, it might help adjust our mental set or the knee-jerk reaction that many, many people seem to have of how can I evade as opposed to how can I fulfill, you know, my civic duty as a believer to serve in this specific context. But I think there's an even greater reason why believers in particular should feel compelled to serve. And really, this is not an argument that would be limited to believers, but really the jury system is there to ultimately to protect us all. It's there to protect us all from governmental overreach and tyranny, because in this particular instance, in the case of criminal proceedings, as you know, it is the state that carries the significant burden of proving that the accused actually committed the crime in question. And serving on a jury gives us the opportunity to put the state to the burden of justifying the harm it wishes to impose on the accused. But serving on a jury is gives us the opportunity to participate in that process because, you know, one day it could very well be the case where we're wrongfully accused of something. And just like we are called to serve in the case of another, we would want others to be willing to serve, because if everybody evaded service, we'd never be able to impanel juries. And it seems like the system would just grind to an overall halt. And so there's an overall systemic concern or argument, I think, that we can take to heart as believers. And as I mentioned at the outset, Melanie, it's not going to be 100% convenient. There's always going to be a measure of inconvenience. But at least here in California, I know it's the case that you can postpone your call to serve to a more convenient time. So, for example, if you have a prepaid vacation and you can't make it, the system understands that, and you can simply reschedule to serve at a later time. So I think that many of the reasons, or let's just be honest and call them excuses, that we use or that we want to use to try to evade an obligation to serve really are a matter of simply postponing the service obligation to a later date when it would be more convenient than maybe it is initially.
One thing about the world and information as it is now, which is almost it's hard to determine if information is accurate, but it's almost real time because of social media and because we are more connected to information than we ever have been. I think trials that have a sense, some kind of measure of notoriety start getting covered. And so maybe somebody has a question like, I would never want to serve on a jury because how do I know I wouldn't get placed on the XYZ trial? Then people find out I was on the trial and people hound me or harass me or try to track me down or reporters try to track me down. Is that a legitimate fear or that's like, you know, less than 1% of the cases? I think some people are concerned that they could, you know, get the ire of the internet if they voted a certain way, if a case becomes very well publicized, even if it's a local case that becomes well publicized in your city.
Well, certainly, you know, there is some risk that that could be the case. But as you mentioned, I think it would be extreme rarity in terms of the number of jury trials that are ongoing in a system at any particular point in time. I think it's probably more like the opposite. Most people who end up serving on a jury, Melanie, end up realizing that most legal cases are pretty commonplace and let's just say boring in comparison to what's often portrayed in the movies or on TV. you know, a typical business dispute in a business, you know, case, complex business litigation matter, for example, typically about failed, you know, business dealings, contracts that weren't fulfilled and things of that nature. And you don't often see too many compelling movies or TV shows made from those plot lines. But there are, you know, a large number of trials. There are the hit and runs that you unfortunately experience. There are slip and falls. There are other personal injury type cases. And often the cases are pretty common and don't rise to kind of that level of sensationalism or fear of any kind of retribution publicly or otherwise by virtue of whatever verdict the jury ends up rendering.
So that really brings me, I want to ask you to this next question is because, you know, we're more connected to information. Why does it seem like murder mysteries or movies about the law or even real world murder trials right now? I guess I didn't know that much about it, but I know a little bit more now. There's this murder trial or supposedly she was accused of murder of Karen Reed up in the Boston area. And like, how did she kill her boyfriend who's a cop or what happened? And then now she's being retried again. So that's like captivating. Whoa, what happened? We're just kind of on the outside. Why is she getting retried again? All these kinds of things. Why do you think there's a fascination with the proliferation really of some of these real world, I mentioned earlier, when we were talking before we started, LawTube, and we kind of emailed about that too. That's really huge now. We have a lot of attorneys, you know, even if they have their own practice, that are on social media talking about all these trials, and people are fascinated by whodunits or unsolved cases or cold cases or murder trials.
Yes, I think, you know, that the law is kind of a laboratory of sorts, Melanie, you know, where human drama unfolds and takes place in oftentimes a gripping way, not always, as I mentioned just a few moments ago, because a lot of legal cases don't rise to that level. I think some people might have a high level of interest in murder mysteries and the like for the wrong reasons, prurient interests and things of that nature. But putting that aside, I just think it's inherently humanly captivating. I think any time you have a compelling plot line drawn along the lines of the seven deadly sins, it's inherently gripping because we're all part of humanity and we're all part of the human condition. We, of course, as believers, believe we have the ultimate answer to some of those predicaments and the ultimate solution for the sin problem that we all have. But it really is something that we all share in common as human beings. And I think the murder mysteries in particular tend to be the most compelling stories of them all. I'd like to suggest, you know, that there might be another reason why some people are attracted to it. Of course, I'm not a psychologist or a psychotherapist, so I can't give you your ultimate answer. But I think that they might make some people in our midst feel better about themselves because nobody's ever done what Justin Kemp did in this film by, you know, hitting somebody with their car and pinning the blame on somebody else, or nobody has ever murdered anybody. So we kind of fancy ourselves and talk ourselves into believing that for that reason, we're better off than the people whose misfortune we have the pleasure of watching. Is that too sarcastic for your take?
No, I mean, I think that there's a measure of that in all of us, especially, and I was talking with someone else in a recent podcast, because we did a podcast when Pastor Lawson, Steve Lawson, fell. And at the time when we were talking about, I think Sean Diddy Combs just got arrested. And I said, well, what about all this? And it was a really good answer. She said, you know, we would be horrified. We were saying, at least we're not as bad as Sean Diddy Combs. We would never do that. But she said, how do you know you would never do that given enough money and all these other power and all these other things? So it's like, I agree with you. And there is something kind of like that drive-by car accident look where we think like, oh, I'm glad that's not me. And we can tend to do that. There's a really horrific case involving an attorney in my area in the Southeast that's probably gained national attention. I don't know where it is now, but involves the Murda family. And it's like you hear the details and you're like, wow, that's crazy. How does anyone get to that point where they would do that? And I think that's the wrong way to look at something, because we don't know, even as Christians, we don't realize we're not better than other people because we're sinners. But I think we can tend to think that, especially when we hear about these murder cases.
Can I connect that for a moment, Mel, to the film, actually? Because I think it's one of the ultimate lessons. Yeah, I think that one of the most sobering truths, you know, that the film portrays is, and one we miss, ironically, is if we act just like Justin Kemp. In other words, he was somebody who was pretty good at pretending to be somebody or something that didn't accord with reality, because deep down he knew that he actually was responsible for Kendall Carter's death. But I think the same thing is true of us all. We can pretend otherwise, but deep down, one of the lessons of the film, one of the morals of it, as it were, is that we're all far more like Justin Kemp, i.e. guilty perpetrators, than we are like James Michael Seith as an innocent victim. And that's because of the sad but accurate biblical truth or observation that we've all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, and that, as we know, the wages of sin is death. The sad reality is that we're all capital offenders before God, Melanie. We may never have hit someone with a car, like I said a moment ago, and pinned it on an innocent person, but we're all spiritual manslayers in that, like Christ said on the Sermon on the Mount, we've all had hate well up in our hearts. And Christ said that was sufficient to condemn us, you know, in the eyes of God. And so we're all like Kemp, responsible before God for everything that we've done. And like Kemp, we too need to satisfy the demands of justice. And that's the glory of the gospel, right? That what we can't do in ourselves already has been done for us by Christ. Christ was the one and the only one who's perfectly innocent. And he's the one who fully faced and satisfied the demands of justice for us. As Paul put it in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, he who knew no sin became sin for us, i.e. the punishment of sin, that we might become the righteousness of God in him. And Peter tells us in 1 Peter chapter 3 that he, Christ, died for us, the just for the unjust. And so what we could never do for ourselves gloriously has been done for us already by our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. But I do think it's one of the lessons we miss from afar if we continue to pretend that we're more like Seith than we are like Kemp in the movie. And so tying, you know, back to your initial question, I think that's one of the main reasons why many people are attracted to storylines that involve, you know, one of the deadly sins, particularly, you know, murders and murder mysteries, because we all like to pretend that we're never going to be as bad as those people that we get to talk about. But deep down, we really all are. And deep down, we're all sinners before God and in the eyes of an all-seeing and all-knowing God. And we all need redemption, and we all need a Savior in Jesus Christ.
Well, given that, though, I would like to know, in terms of the legal system, I mean, everybody will say, you know, we know that you're innocent until your guilt is proven. So innocent until proven guilty. But a lot of times, especially when we hear a case or we see the circumstances knowing that a case is going to trial, you know, how come this person seems so incredibly guilty? Why would we say that they're innocent? It seems like, you know, there's proof that they were there at the time of the crime, whatever the crime was, whether it was, you know, robbery or murder or something else, and that they did this. And why do they come into the court system as quote unquote innocent until they're proven guilty?
That's a great question. Again, we see news headlines every day, you know, whether it's the, you know, senseless murder of the CEO of UnitedHealthcare or what have you in the relatively recent past. And I think that in answering that question, Melanie, and again, it's a major theme that, you know, jumps out of the film, that we're presumed innocent until the state satisfies its proof obligation. And that's because notwithstanding the rigors of our legal system, the system, as I mentioned before, doesn't always get it right. There are miscarriages of justice that do happen, sadly. And that's because human justice, by definition, is imperfect, because everyone who participates in it is imperfect, whether it's the accused or witnesses or legal counsel, the judge, jurors, everybody who's kind of responsible for the system outcome is imperfect. And I think that's one of the major themes that's poignantly portrayed in the film, that sometimes what a jury concludes happens isn't necessarily what happened. But that's precisely why and where we need the presumption of innocence until guilt's established. And I think there's two reasons that we as believers can begin to grasp why our system presumes the accused to be innocent instead of guilty. Let me back up for just a minute and say that there's only two ways a presumption can flow in this instance. We could presume that the accused is guilty, or we can presume that the accused is innocent, right? The problem is, depending upon which way that presumption flows, that's how the burden of proof follows. So we don't want a system where the accused is presumed to be guilty, because that puts the proof burden on the accused to establish innocence instead of putting the proof burden on the state to prove that the accused actually committed the crime in question. So there's a public policy response that I think provides some satisfaction in that presuming innocence puts the burden of proof on the state as a cross-check against governmental overreach and tyranny. And I think we can easily understand how that protects us all, because there are compelling stories, actual news stories, and the reality that we all could be accused of doing something that we didn't do. And if we're in that situation, we want the presumption that we're innocent, because that puts the proof burden on the state to show that the crime was actually committed. As one scholar once put it, presuming innocence simply puts the burden on the state to justify the harm it wishes to impose upon the accused. And I think if we look at it that way, we can see from a public policy standpoint why we would want the presumption flowing in favor of innocence as opposed to guilt. But I also think that there's something even more compelling for believers, and something that believers might miss from afar. But the presumption, the legal presumption of innocence, is actually a very biblical concept going back to the Old Testament. Is it okay if I explain that for a couple of minutes here, Melanie?
Oh, yeah, please do. I think I would like Christians to be able to understand some of this better, because one of the things that we cover on the journal is Christian ethics. So I think it's very important.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. So I guess we can start with pages of the Old Testament in Deuteronomy 17:6. This is now, you know, God himself speaking, delivering the law to Moses, the Mosaic law, as it were. But God himself says that on the evidence of two witnesses or of three witnesses, the one who is to die shall be put to death. A person shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness. And just two chapters later in Deuteronomy 19, verse 5, God adds, kind of in the second iteration of this same principle, that a single witness shall not suffice against a person for any crime or for any wrong in connection with any offense that he has committed. Only on the evidence of two witnesses or three witnesses shall a charge be established. When I see these two passages, Melanie, I can deduce three what I call justice principles from them. The first justice principle is that due process or fairness has to govern all legal proceedings, God says, for any crime or for any wrong. The second justice principle I see here is that the burden of proving legal guilt must be satisfied before a charge can be established or an accused can be punished. In this instance, that burden of proof, as per the Mosaic law, for a capital offense was two or three witnesses, not a single witness. And the third justice principle that I can deduce from these two passages is that if that proof burden is not satisfied, or whatever the proof burden is under the legal system that's governing, if the proof burden isn't satisfied, the accused shouldn't be convicted or punished. Again, this is what God says. A person shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness, and only on the evidence of two or three witnesses shall a charge be established. What's particularly astounding in this passage, especially in the Deuteronomy 19, verse 5, 1, is that God presumes both the offense and the inability to establish the proof burden, because God says on the mouth of one witness, the accused shouldn't be convicted or punished for any offense that he has committed, not any offense that he allegedly has committed, but any offense that he has committed. So, you know, quite astoundingly, God assumes both the offense and an inability to prove it. So I would argue that presuming innocence, the legal presumption of innocence until guilt is proven, goes all the way back to biblical law in the pages of the Old Testament. But it doesn't stop there. As we know, Romans chapter 7 teaches us that God's law is holy and just and good. Christ himself taught us that he came not to abolish the law, but rather to fulfill it. And what we find in the pages of the New Testament is that the New Testament assumes, applies, and expands these Old Testament justice principles that we were just alluding to. In several instances, the author of Hebrews tells us that people died without mercy on the evidence of two or three witnesses in Hebrews 10, verse 28. Paul forbids church members from making uncooperated accusations against church elders. Here's what he says: don't admit a charge against an elder except on the evidence of two or three witnesses. That's from 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 19. Christ taught us that when believers get into disagreements with one another, that the offended brother is to take along with him to the offending brother two or three witnesses, so that on the mouth of two or three witnesses, every charge shall be established. That's Matthew chapter 18, verse 16. And Paul did so very interestingly by telling the believers in Corinth that he was going to go back to them multiple times. He goes, this is the third time I'm coming to you. Every charge must be established by the evidence of two or three witnesses. That's in 2 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 1. So we can see this presumption of innocence and this proof burden obligation runs completely throughout the pages of Holy Scripture. And so I believe that ultimately the legal presumption of innocence for the accused is something that's grounded in the pages of Holy Scripture itself.
You mentioned just a few minutes ago, alluded to the situation in New York earlier this year with a healthcare CEO who was gunned down at close range. And a suspect has been arrested, Luigi Mangione, and it's gone kind of viral, that whole story, people. And I want to ask you about that. It does relate to this question because I think people see what he did. And I've listened to actual whole podcasts. They're not legal ones, but they wanted to talk about their cultural ones. They wanted to talk about this, and they're not Christian podcasts. And they're like, hey, I think what he did was wrong, but I get why he did it. Is there a sense in which, you know, on the flip side, we can feel the sense of injustice and say that the only means because something was like a big corporation wasn't doing justice, what we think would be justice, then therefore they need to be punished. And so I wonder about that because I feel like sometimes Christians use the whole method of, you know, situational ethics, and that could come to it. Well, yeah, murder's wrong, but I mean, I have sympathy for this guy because he was in this, you know, maybe we've had that situation. We've been in extreme pain. We've been denied coverage, or we've been denied certain procedures. And that's just that case, the medical case. But what about other ways that we see something and we go, yeah, I can understand why that person did that because this company didn't treat them well, or et cetera.
Right. I guess we start with the biblical principle where God says, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. It's not up to us to exact vengeance. That's what the legal system is for. We as individuals don't carry the sword. The state, it's the scripture says, doesn't carry the sword in vain. It's up to the state to prosecute wrongdoers and to pursue and prosecute wrongdoers, and to mete out whatever the just rewards are in their particular instance. What's particularly baffling about the Mangione case is, if I'm allowed to mention his name, is that, you know, he did not personally suffer any injustice at the hands of UnitedHealthcare or any insurance carrier, so far as I know. He comes from generational wealth, heavily invested in the insurance industry, in fact. And so it's a little bit baffling why some people have elevated him to the role of being a hero. I don't think he's a hero. I cannot speak to the legal outcome of his case, but I do believe as an attorney and even as a believer that he is allowed to enter a not guilty plea and put the state to the test of proving the harm it wishes to impose on him, as we spoke about a few moments ago. He certainly could have entered a no contest plea, or he could have entered a guilty plea or whatever, but he didn't do that. And he's just simply putting the state to the test. From all I've seen and heard and read, it shouldn't be that hard for the state to prove what he did. But we'll leave that up to the legal system specifically involved in his particular case. But I would say that Christians have to at all costs distance themselves from this kind of thinking, because it really is an end justifies the means, or situational ethic, as you called it, Melanie. And it's not our job or our role to exact or carry out, to be the judge and jury prosecuting people and visiting the ultimate punishment on them of murdering them for what an injustice that we might perceive. That's not to say that injustices don't occur in our world or in our country. They certainly do. They occur every single day. But it's up to the people ordained by God and called by God to fulfill their role and their obligations. It's not up to us as individual citizens to take the matter into our own hands.
Well, that brings me to another question that was in the movie, because you mentioned that there was a character played by J.K. Simmons who was a retired police officer who decides, you know, this doesn't seem to add up. So he's already seated on the jury. And I don't know that he mentions that he's a retired police officer in the film, but he goes and does some independent research himself and starts suggesting it to the, for dramatic purposes, to the main character, Kemp, in this instance. But why does the legal system frown upon independent juror research? And I was also reminded of that too, because one of the alternates that, you know, replaces him, I think, she didn't do independent research, but she was that similar kind of person where she loves legal shows, she listens to all the podcasts, so she had all these opinions, but she was not an attorney, but she feels like she knows everything about the law because she follows LawTube and she you know, does deep dives into cases.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Yeah, the character is Harold Chakowski, as we mentioned, and played by J.K. Simmons. He did an incredible job in the role. He did at one point, I don't know if you recall, he slammed his police badge, you know, from being a detective, kind of on the table as his bona fides, you know, to kind of say, I know what I'm talking about, I'm not an idiot. And he got the jury to sit up and kind of take notice of that. So yeah, he was a former detective who took it upon himself, as I mentioned a few moments ago, to conduct an independent investigation in the middle of jury deliberations. And to the average viewer, it might appear to be justified. And I think this is what you were getting at, because who wouldn't want to know the truth of what actually happened? And this is unfortunately where the system as a system can sometimes clash with our gut reactions. What I want to propose is that the system has to prevent these kinds of independent investigation attempts, because the system is trying to guarantee to the greatest extent possible that there's no taint in or of the process. And it's really part and parcel of what we call in the law, the rules of evidence, that in part forbid these kinds of independent investigations and dictate what kinds of evidence can be admitted and what kinds of evidence should be excluded, i.e. the kinds of things the jury should never hear, or if they happen to hear, are instructed to completely disregard, you know, by the court, because the goal is to prevent judicial taint. And I think lay people can struggle with this, right? Because it seems so far afield from how we live our, you know, everyday lives. You know, can you imagine a child, you know, sitting around the table saying, "Hey, mommy, you know, Sally told me," and the mom objects, you know, because what her child is saying calls for hearsay. I mean, we don't, you know, we don't live our lives with the same kind of exactitude and the same kind of rigor that our legal system has to demand to do the best job that it can to protect the outcome. And what I like to suggest to people who struggle with grasping that concept is to think of the rules of evidence as simply a higher standard that's designed to try to protect the outcome as much as possible. So by analogy, maybe this will help. You know, when we're cooking dinner, you know, tonight at home, we know that clean room standards aren't part of that process. Certainly we can design a clean room kitchen if that's our preoccupation, but you know, we don't have to have HEPA air filters or control temperatures and humidity levels. We don't have to guarantee proper airflow or wear, you know, shower caps and special attire and protective equipment, etc. But that doesn't mean that clean room standards, you know, for the manufacturing of medical devices or computer chips don't have their time and place. They certainly have their time and place or their appropriate context. And I guess I'd like to suggest by analogy, Melanie, that the same's true for the rules of evidence. It's simply a higher standard to prevent, in this instance, judicial contamination. So the rules of evidence and the prohibition against independent research and investigation is meant to make sure that evidence that's unfounded or irrelevant or unduly prejudicial or redundant, speculative or inferior or otherwise unreliable doesn't come into the process to potentially impact or affect or taint outcome, as I mentioned earlier. So I think that's why independent investigations are really precluded. And I guess my ultimate observation there, Melanie, is that legal trials by legal design are closed universe systems. Maybe that's the easiest way to grasp the concept, that the jury, as the legal fact finder in a jury trial, is limited to the evidence and only the evidence that the judge has properly admitted into evidence for purposes of that proceeding. And if we have any concern that judges might get it wrong, they do sometimes, and they sometimes even get it wrong when it comes to evidence that they admit or evidence that they exclude that they should have admitted. But that's why we have appellate courts to review the outcome, even on their rulings on evidentiary issues that arise in the course of trial. Does that help kind of scratch where you're itching a little there on that issue?
Yeah, and I have one more question that the film brought up that I'm sure some listeners are probably hoping that I'm going to ask. And one of the main characters is Toni Collette. She's a great actress. And I don't know, it's kind of like, what do you call it? A trivia. But years ago when Nicholas Hoult was a little kid, they were in a movie together with another really famous actor, Hugh Grant. And that was like one of his big roles. And so now they're both in this film again, all these years later. But she plays this assistant district attorney, and she's prosecuting this case. But there's also an element of There's an election going on, and so she needs to have a win. And then so you see her with the, and I don't know if this is true, with the defense attorney, and they're at the bar and they're trying to, you know, wheel and deal and all that kind of stuff. We see that. And then sometimes, like, why are people getting off, or why did they take a plea? And maybe that's too much. But I was thinking about this film when, and this is where David lives. Maybe not everybody knows about it, but they might now know about it now because they have had some TV shows based on the whole Menendez brothers trial in, I think it was at the late 80s, early 90s, something like that. And I remember, I was alive then, and I remember living in California, the whole Menendez thing. And of course, that was another one where, like, they are so guilty. Like, why would they go on the shopping spree and all this stuff? So now there's this new TV series on Netflix or whatever it is, and there's a documentary that comes out. And so now that they're kind of saying, oh, we need to resentence them. And so that's kind of what's happening right now because of these TV shows, I think, that's even come forth. And so people might have thought of that case as they looked at this film, if they saw it, because it came around at the same time as it's going. It's like, how does that seem like it's justice when all the attorneys talk to each other and there's discovery and then they have, you know, just different things that are happening? It seems like, does the person really get justice because there's all these other behind the scenes wheeling and dealing, or is that just in the movies?
Well, yeah, I mean, oftentimes lawyers do talk to one another. I don't know about the limits in terms of the legal, ethical propriety or impropriety of prosecutors and defense counsel and their ability to talk, you know, with great detail, you know, outside of court. I know in my civil practice, you know, we talk to opposing counsel, as we call them, very frequently, because even in the civil context, obviously cases settle. 90 to 95% of civil cases resolve before they ever get to trial on average. But yeah, in terms of the Menendez brothers, you know, I lived through it. I'm a little older than you are, I think, based on your chronological reckoning of your age. I was a lot older at the time. And that's a tough one. I think, you know, it goes back to the former district attorney for the city of Los Angeles, Gascon, who was obviously funded by George Soros, and who had, you know, let's call it somewhat Marxist view of the criminal justice system that seemed to try to go after the innocent and try to let the guilty go free. And I think he was a very soft on crime DA. And I think that's why he's been replaced by somebody who has a much more solid biblical perspective. Let's just put it that way, in terms of where justice should be meted out. And I think he's taking his job very seriously, and he's fully reconsidering kind of what Gascon was trying to do in that instance. But yeah, we live in times where people want to evade punishment for kind of what they have done. I don't know if the outcome would be different if the Menendez brothers were tried today anew. Like, if this just happened and they were tried today, you know, one wonders whether, you know, and to what extent the Me Too movement impact would have been, and whether the defense story that they tried to sell back in the 80s would fly more today than it did then. But it doesn't appear to me, as an outside observer, that the jury got it wrong then. And I don't think that their punishment should be revisited today. But again, I'm not an expert in the Menendez brothers case either. So,
yeah, so these are all interesting things. I think a lot of us are armchair attorneys when it comes to these cases that we see. Well, you alluded to it earlier when you talked about just sin and the gospel, but are there any other takeaways that, as Christians, that we can consider as if people go and watch this film? And I do think Christians can see this film. This film doesn't have very much bad language, I think, and there is no sexuality in it. So a lot of times we're asked the question when we review books or films, is this something a Christian could watch? And I've seen the film, and I do think it's something a Christian could watch. But are there any other takeaways that Christians could have?
Some that we've already spoken about briefly. You know, first, the importance of jury service, even for believers, and understanding why, and the, you know, Harold's independent investigation was precluded in this instance. We've mentioned some of the bad decisions that Kemp made in terms of not calling the police right away, or telling his wife that night where he had really been, or not coming forward as soon as he remembered. But there were some other bad decisions he made that I'm not sure we've actually touched on. If you recall, Melanie, he's the one who actually called attention to Chakowski's, juror Harold Chakowski's body shop list, because Harold approached camp about working together with him to check out the cars on that list. Of course, Kemp knew that his car was on that list. Harold knew that Kemp's car was on that list, but they were going to dismiss it because everybody knew, those two knew, he couldn't possibly have done it. But then if you remember, Kemp acts like he's interested in helping Chakowsky, and then he intentionally drops the papers in front of the bailiff. Well, that's the very thing that results in the bailiff hauling Kemp and Chakowsky in front of the judge. Chakowsky falls on the sword and gets excused from the jury. For some reason, Kemp doesn't. He stays on the jury, but Kemp is the one who actually called the court's attention to the body shop list. And by doing that, the judge had to hold that hearing to exclude Chakowsky in front of counsel and the accused. And that's when the prosecutor, Faith Killebrew, Toni Collette, as you said, played by Toni Collette, that's when she discovers the list. And then she's the one who actually conducts that investigation and traces Kemp's car to Kemp's wife because it was registered in her name. And so things kind of went from bad to worse there for his strategic decision to drop the list in front of the bailiff. But I think the real story is the conflict of interest and him just covering up the truth and ultimately trying to pin his own guilt on Scythe. What's ironic is that Kemp was involved in an accident, but by virtue of the cover-up, actually committed a crime of his own by pinning his guilt on an otherwise innocent person. And so he uses an end justifies the mean ethic to try to protect himself selfishly and his family, maybe nobly, but in the end, he made things far worse for himself and for his family. And I think that just ultimately, the ultimate moral of the film, as I said before, is we miss the whole point of the film if we don't see a little bit of ourselves in Kemp. And if we pretend that we're more like Scythe than we are like Kemp, because then we're pretending that we're not guilty before an all-seeing and all-knowing God.
Well, this has been a very fascinating discussion, and I hope that David will come back and join us sooner than 400 episodes. But on a much lighter note, I'm going to do some of the fun questions we did probably with David back years ago. And we've had so many new listeners since then, they probably didn't hear it. But David, would you say that you're an early bird or a night owl?
I'm an early bird. I wake up between 3:30 and 4:30 in the morning almost every day.
Wow. And also, one of the questions I like to ask is, we know you've mentioned in this podcast that you live in the state of California. What is one of your favorite things about living in California?
Definitely the weather, and definitely not the taxes.
Well, thanks, David, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Melanie. And it's a pleasure to have the opportunity to visit with you again.
You've been listening to episode 439 of the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was David Hagopian. He has written an online film review article for the Christian Research Journal, and his review is called The Juror Number 2 in Everyone, and you can read it for free on equip.org. You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.